Welcome to 2-Bit Encryption, the officially unofficial podcast for Mr. Robot on USA. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about Season 2, Episode 3, titled Episode 2.1 Kernel Panic.KSD.
Yeah.
We'll go with that. I'm not gonna say the letters.
You're not gonna do lead speak. You don't speak lead speak, Jim.
I can't bring myself. I'm not gonna say K3 kernel. That's not gonna happen.
All right. Fair enough.
But just know that whenever I say kernel panic, there are numbers in there somewhere. You can determine at your own leisure. I'm doing a remote show from Colorado today, so apologies if this is a little different than usual. But, you know, the show must go on.
Yeah, and this is the first time we've spoken since you left a couple days ago. And, you know, we've both seen Mr. Robot, so I think the most important thing that I need to ask you at this point is, what strange and exotic Pokemon are you catching in the mountains of Colorado?
I caught a pony, a fire pony. I don't know what they're called.
Just kidding. We're not going to make this Poke Talk. But what did you think of the episode, man?
I thought it was real good. Aside from just very small issues I have with it, another excellent episode, and like maybe has the best montage they've ever done, in my opinion.
Sure.
Where Elliot gets real happy and then real sad back to back.
About the immaculate dishes.
Yeah. Right. Yep. And him like walking up the stairs. There's a lot of really cool stuff in there, but we'll get to that. I just think that part was amazing.
I think this might be the funniest Mr. Robot episode, and I use that in like every sense of the word funny. Like there was some just moments of comedy that kind of won me over, but I felt like there's a couple of points at I felt there's a couple points in this episode where things got to be a little too much. And a lot of this is the usual suspects clustered around Price. Some of it was like Elliot's speech about religion in the middle. But then the weird thing is I keep, after I think about it for a bit and then I read feedback and I go on Reddit and I see some of these people, you know, in interpretations of these scenes and some of the allegories that they're laying just really thick on the show. And I battle these two impulses. One is, you know, is this going to be like True Detective where this stuff is pleasing in the moment, but ultimately it's not clues so much as just like little dopamine rewards for paying attention. It doesn't have any predictive value. And the other feeling is like, oh my God, like how deep does this rabbit hole go? And like this, right. Okay, now I have new appreciation for, I was so distracted by the surface level content being delivered in Elliot's rant about religion that I didn't get the deeper character meaning. And I keep swinging back and forth that way a lot on a lot of these characters and moments. And it didn't help that, like, you know, I thought it was awesome last week how they went minimal commercial interruption. This week I would describe it as maximal commercial interruption, like the very lengthy and frequent. Like I felt like every ad that was missing from last week is inserted in this week in a live show, and it is very jumbled. I found it, you know, didn't really cohere or come together. And then when I watched the second time, I was able to zap through the commercials. I'm like, okay, this was quite a bit better. So I was all over the map with this episode.
Yeah, I get what you're saying about the commercials. I felt a lot of that too. Normally I watch it on like DVR or whatever, so yeah. I can skip those.
Right.
And it's not too much of a disruption, but yeah, this time, ooh boy, there were a lot of them.
Yeah. And you know, that's the thing. I do, at the end of the day, I feel like this was about an hour of material. I felt like maybe this would be stronger with about 5 minutes taken out of it. And I can say this, I would have been a little bit more positive, except for, you know, I felt like you took the positive take, and I agree with everything you said. Like, this is another really awesome episode of Mr. Robot, and it's beautiful, and it works on many levels. I just felt like that, you know, those are the weaknesses that I saw, I don't know. And again, this could be Sam Esmail working at a higher level storytelling in some of these scenes that I'm just not getting. But then again, it could be, you know, True Detective 1, where the daughter is making spiral graphs, and it just turns out she was making spiral graphs. So,
right.
What are you going to do?
Okay. Well, maybe we can get more into detail in the recap. What do you say?
Let's do it.
All right, we start off with a flashback to Romero giving Mobley a tour of the Fun Society arcade while he tells the pretty grisly story of this possibly cursed placed history.
I think this is the next season of American Horror Story. This is the plot line.
Right, the arcade that wouldn't die.
Might even be the next three seasons of American Horror Story.
Might be. So Mobley tells him that his guy, who at this point we know is, well, depending on your theory, is either Elliot or Mr. Robot, not only wants to use the place, but he also wants to recruit him to do a job with him.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't seem like Romero's quite on board yet. I guess it all depends on the money, as he says.
Yeah.
I guess there's a term in here that a lot of people might not understand, this freaker term that Mobley uses, which is basically just the term for a hacker who focuses on telecommunications systems. So you'd hear a lot about freakers back in, you know, the 70s when it was like real easy to do this stuff. You could do it with literally a Captain Crunch whistle that came out of that box.
Right.
So that's what that means.
Yeah, and you get alignment handsets and
right,
you know, make long distance phone calls on your neighbor's dime. There's like all, I mean, essentially, you know, this is a Matthew Broderick's War Games kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So, okay, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
So I was gonna say, there's this interesting line right off the bat here where he's talking about Mobley being too ADD to really take in the world, didn't know all this stuff was here, which
right.
is a pretty good line in an episode where Elliot overdoses purposely on Adderall.
Sure. What did you, when I was watching the second time, I was listening for like this, these parts of the stories that kind of didn't make sense. And the last one about Clyde, the guy that was the friend of Romero and bought the arcade in 2004 and turned it into its modern incarnation. Did you think that Clyde actually is guilty of the crime and this is just prison bullshit? You know, because like you can either believe that the guy, his brother shot his father with a shotgun, didn't expect a recoil, it flew him out the window and the gun stayed in the floor, and Clyde was just asleep, happened to be asleep in the same
right.
house, or you can make the jump, easy jump to logic to Clyde shot his old man and shoved his brother out the window and was guilty of the crime that he committed.
Right, and just maintains his innocence to this day.
Right, I mean,
in prison, sure.
I mean, I watched Shawshank. I know the deal. There's no guilty men in prison.
Of course not.
And I felt like that. Maybe that's something I'm supposed to be asking because, again, it's my fucking weekly segment. Jim, is any of this shit real? Like, you cannot rely on anyone passing information, even if they sincerely believe it's true. It's like, just take a step back and, like, this is kind of a funhouse universe, the whole
sure.
thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a couple of places where you can kind of ground yourself. Like, basically when Elliot's not on the screen or involved in a particular scene, and Mr. Robot isn't, and Tyrell isn't, like, I think you can start to ground yourself in some of Ray's scenes.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right,
and Darlene.
They may, I mean, I felt like everything I thought I knew about Dom, the FBI agent, last week about her being confident and outgoing and like the anti-Elliot was fucking wrong. She's almost a Tyrell type that she is faking this, I guess, not competence, but this social comfort, and that she's just kind of as weird and sleep deprived and not crazy yet that we know of, but then again, you know, how long it takes us to realize how disturbed Elliot was. You know what I'm saying? Like you're right. I mean, I guess you could say as a rule that if Elliot or Mr. Robot isn't on the screen, you can trust what's going on. But I feel like the more we introduce these characters and the more that they have their own psychological issues, the more kind of, you know, a lot of things are thrown into doubt.
And that's fair, too, because, I mean, Ray, we find out, is dealing with his own set of psychological issues
around
the death of his wife.
He's talking to his kidney dialysis machine.
Right. So it's like, how much do you trust him at this point? And maybe, like, you don't come at it from the angle of, oh, maybe they're all Elliot. But, you know, this show ultimately is about mental illness in a lot of ways. And we might be seeing a lot of people who are mentally ill in a lot of different ways.
Yeah. Did you think that this opening was very Quentin Tarantino?
I didn't get that vibe. Why do you say that?
Like, it's consciously dialogue heavy. It wasn't edited. It's like someone just wrote a script. It's this whole conversation. We got all of it. And the way, even the cadence it was delivered was like one of those self-consciously cool Tarantino moments. And then when we get the Dusty Springfield track, you know, this 60s, 70s kind of anthem thing going with these sweeping shots in New York, I felt it was a bit... you know, very opening of a Tarantino movie.
Okay, sure.
But I don't know. And then the other thing is, what did you think of the final statement from Romero where Mobley asked him what happened to the U and N, and he's like, oh, well, that's a story for a different time. I thought that was Tarantino, too, and also
okay,
maybe threatening to be, like, this whole scene maybe threatening to be over the top, because, like, the Tarantino stuff gets away with it because it's all so fascinating, right? And I felt like this lacked just, like, 10% of that crispiness in the dialogue and that crackle. So, okay. I don't know.
Yeah.
I hope I don't come across as shitting on this episode. That's the last thing I want.
I'm sure we'll get to some parts that you really like, and we can talk about those.
I thought you were going to say, well, I'm sure we'll get to the parts where you really hate, and then there'll be no doubt.
The other thing that they're doing in this scene that maybe, for me, kind of, you know, smooths over that 10% that you're talking about is the sort of matching themes of these stories with the show at large, with, you know, the kid shooting his dad in the head, the guy going backward out the window. Like, you can see a lot of parallels.
Sure, that's Elliot's prologue and epilogue at this point. You know, his dad pushed him out a window, and now his dad's shooting him in the head. So,
and a lot of it feels very loose. It's not like these are exactly the things that have happened to these exact people, but it's creating a certain milieu here.
The other thing I want to talk about is, what do you think about Mr. Robot's use of stealth F-bombs? There were at least half a dozen, if not more, in this episode. I like it. Like, I think the fact that you're stealth F-bombing these things is dumb. Like, I mean, if you're watching this with your kid in the room, I think you got bigger things to worry about than the fact that they might hear the word fuck from time to time. But if this is the, you know, deal I have to make with puritanical America to avoid, you know, straining to go around that kind of authentic dialogue, then I guess I'm okay with it, because I see a bolder... I feel like this dialogue felt more natural than some of the stuff you see on, like, The Walking Dead or, you know, even Breaking Bad and Mad Men from time to time would be robbed of rightful uses of F words. What did you think?
I'm glad that they're actually saying it, even if they are bleeping it out, because, you know, on the DVD set, you're going to get the full unedited version, right?
Right.
So they can at least write the way they want to write and not have to worry about that.
Yeah.
Okay, so as you mentioned, we get the credit sequence with some helicopter or maybe even drone shots of New York.
I was wondering, because... I mean, they were amazing. They were really amazing. Kind of adds to the unhinged quality that you kind of come up on this tower, go over it, and then you continue. The camera just now it's looking at it upside down.
Yeah.
You know, that's all within the show's wheelhouse and theme. But I wondered the same thing, too. It's like, can you get that nice of a camera, that stable? I mean, I've seen, like, what the Mythbusters do, but, like, that was just beautiful.
It was. And Elliot's narrating over it and kind of comes in with his panic, burrowing under and nesting and screaming in his mind as we cut back to his call with Tyrell. And he's trying to figure out, where are you and what happened the night of the hack? And he actually almost gets Tyrell to tell him before Mr. Robot ends the call abruptly. And Elliot sees on the news Gideon has been murdered.
Mm-hmm. I also love how Elliot at this point is fully embracing my segment of, is this real? Because he's himself asking, like Mr. Robot's like, what more do you want? You just talked to him. You just heard him. He's like, but I talked to you too. And the whole audience is like, yes, that's a good point.
Right.
What's your money on? Do you think that this, you know, obviously I was epically wrong with my thought that this was the assassin.
Right. It's definitely Tyrell.
Yeah.
But
do you think it's definitely Tyrell, or do you think it's...
Well,
you know,
I mean, who do you think Tyrell is at this point? Is Tyrell alive? Is Tyrell a real person? Is he now part of Elliot's psyche? Like, I think any of those could be true.
Yeah.
All we know for sure is that whatever Tyrell is on the other end of that line, it's now part of the mystery of what Elliot needs to figure out here.
I guess I've been thinking about this of late, and I've come to the conclusion that I do think that Tyrell's still alive, because I do think that he's the one sending the phone to Joanna. Although, I guess I could be talked into that being Elliot, too. That's Mr. Robot part of his psyche trying to stir the shit or keep his end of the bargain going or something. So maybe, I don't know, I mean, I don't... Clearly, you know, I did some more digging. Several people confirmed that there is a gun in that popcorn machine.
Right.
You know, they conspicuously had Elliot going for it. He blacked out. He woke up in Tyrell's car. Those are the facts that we know.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't add up too much in the hill of beans in the universe of Mr. Robot. So I guess I think he's still alive. If I had to go with my gut, what's your gut say?
Okay, that's funny because I've actually come around to the other side of this. And now,
of course.
I think that he's not alive. I think Elliot killed him.
So
the popcorn gun makes a lot of sense.
So you think Mr. Robot is sending her? He's the one sending her the phone.
Yep. And Tyrell, this phone call is now all in his head. I think a lot of that makes sense. He's trying to figure out what happened the night of the hack, and Tyrell, as part of his psyche, is some. It's an avenue for him to investigate his own memories. Right.
Okay. No. Wait a second. So you've come all the way around, and the Tyrell's has always been a figment of Mr. Robot?
No.
Okay,
no.
Okay. So he's absorbed that part of him.
Yes, and now that memory of him killing him and doing the hack, that's all wrapped up in this voice of Tyrell on the phone, which is not real.
Gotcha. Okay.
That's where I'm coming from, and there's no real, like, super good evidence other than popcorn gun and a conspicuous cut to inform us, but whatever.
Right.
I'm sure I'll be proven wrong next episode, you'll come back around.
Well, and that's the other thing, and now that I'm thinking about it, like, anytime Elliot's telling us that we should be skeptical of what we're seeing, I'm like, huh, maybe this is happening just straight up, you know? I'm trying to dip and dodge and weave here, so, like, if he's telling us, oh, then maybe this is fake, well, then maybe that's double secretly real.
Yeah, this show, man.
I know.
I don't know what to think anymore.
I know. And like I said, when I started doing the I'm seeing all the religious and historical allusions that are being piled onto these episodes, I'm like, this is intense, man. And the fact that I also got some email about some ARG they've already played, and like I know that we'll talk about that in the feedback section. And they're doing a lot of crazy things. Like, have you seen the Mr. Robot site? Who is Mr. Robot.com?
Yeah, I saw that.
And they're
a lot
embedding
of good stuff in there.
Yeah, they're embedding clues and stuff, and you can go off script at that. And they had the binary code or the hexadecimal code of Elliot's kernel panic message, and that you could decode that. And it's
So when we get crazy to those scenes, I think for people who don't know what we're talking about, haven't been looking around on Reddit lately, I'm going to go over a couple of those things when we get there.
Okay, cool.
So if you're like, what the fuck are they talking about, just stick around for a bit.
All right.
Mobley goes to visit Romero at home, but he's been shot dead.
Who killed Mobley, Jim?
Wow. Well, it could be Ray.
Sure.
Because I think Ray's into some bad shit, and we'll talk about that later. It could be... I guess it could be Elliot.
Well, or like the show seems us the show itself raises the possibility that it's the Dark Army with Elliot, you know, essentially cleaning up these loose ends that are his former collaborators, right?
Right. I mean, that's basically what I was getting at.
Okay, good.
It could be Elliot, or potentially even Darlene herself.
Elliot himself, I don't know that he has the resources for it.
Right.
Although I guess I don't know if he could social engineer one kooky guy to kill a good man, he could do it again. So,
yeah.
But then also Darlene throws the suggestion, which seems kind of self-serving to me. But then again, you know, this show being what it is, that this is just a standard drug hit. This guy was selling mass quantities of weed, and you know we know what a fucking bloodbath that market is.
Right.
Someone came and capped him.
Could be. She said from the beginning, this guy is kind of a wild card, right? He could be a loose end given
right.
his drug operation.
And then they kind of it's interesting that they juxtaposed his death with the cold open, where he seemed the very reluctant entry, and we also know that, you know, Elliot slash Mr. Robot had to pull a gun on him last year when he started to waver, and is so that kind of supports that maybe it's a Darlene or Elliot angle.
Yeah, maybe. Then we go over to Ray, sitting in his dining room eating, doing dialysis, and talking to someone that we don't see. But, of course, we later find out that he's talking to his dead wife.
Yeah, it's funny because I was looking at him like, man, it's just off the way they framed this damn shot. You can't see who he's talking to. I assumed it was going to be someone right. else, but, you know, I guess I didn't. You know, I see a man chowing down on bacon. I don't think he's, like, hooked up to dialysis.
Right, yeah, it was surprising. I thought he was talking to someone else who was, and maybe, I'm like, how long are these fucking tubes?
Yeah. What,
are they in the kitchen pouring a Mountain Dew or something?
Right, yeah. Yeah, that threw me the first time I watched it.
Yep, all makes sense in hindsight, though. We move on to Leon meeting Elliot at the basketball court with a covert delivery of Adderall, and Mr. Robot shows up, questions what the drugs are going to accomplish, and then Elliot begins downing pill after pill as he tells us that he's trying to induce a kernel panic. Mm-hmm. And then at the end of the scene, he's abducted.
Yeah, the thing that I don't understand is what is it about, because it seems like he just is using the Adderall as, you know, a form of speed to deny himself sleep.
Right.
So is that what he's referring to as overdosing on, because the first time when I hear him, I'm going to overdose on Ritalin or Adderall, I'm thinking, well, that's a bizarre way to kill yourself.
Right.
So I don't know. Did he have to just get his massive dose of Adderall in his system and then maintain it? Is that what I'm supposed to get from this? Or was he, I mean, why did he take like 10 pills?
I'm not 100% sure. The kernel panic idea to me is that he wants to sort of crash and reboot his brain.
Right.
But I'm not sure why he thinks that's necessarily going to get rid of Mr. Robot.
Right.
Maybe he's just keeping Mr. Robot at bay long enough for, you know, his lack of sleep to do the crash and reboot sort of thing.
So it's interesting that they use this kernel panic idea, which is when an operating system gets to an unstable state and it knows that it's got several internal checks. It's like, whoop, this isn't right. This, you know, I can't necessarily figure out how I got here. I can't necessarily recover, and I can no longer guarantee that I haven't been hacked or that, you know, my systems are synchronized and my memory registers are all properly noted and this could be a security problem. So I'm going to force a crash and dump a bunch of shit out for diagnosis purposes. So it's interesting that, like, it's a very biological way of doing this, that, Elliot has detected that his internal processes aren't running right. He's not sure how he got there. He doesn't think he can recover, so he's going to reboot himself. But I just didn't get the overdose part of it. If he's like, I'm going to take Ritalin so I don't go to sleep, and that's going to, you know, the sleep is when Mr. Robot holds sway. Like, I felt that would have tracked cleaner. There's just something about the overdose thing that I couldn't figure out.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. I'm not sure exactly how that tracks either. But
yeah,
maybe some of our listeners will have some insight next week.
What did you think about the scene of the men in black abducting him and forcing cement down his throat?
Right.
Like, and then, like, you see in Elliot's throwing up all this stuff. It looks like he's throwing up grits with medicine in and picking it out and re-eating. That's another scenes where it's like I kept on like, man, is this too much? But by the end, it was so awesome, and Malik is so committed to it that it won me over.
Yeah, that scene was real gross. But it, like you said, it was also awesome. So I didn't mind it too much.
Did you get any Team America World Police flashbacks from it?
I guess so,
the
yeah.
The epic vomiting with the right. music and yeah.
Yeah, but it's so good because, you know, it becomes apparent that this whole ruse, this whole van thing with the cement and everything is Mr. Robot trying to regain control of Elliot.
Right.
And Elliot protesting and just like doing one of the most unimaginably disgusting things that I can think of in the moment.
Right.
to prove that he will not be owned. And he is actually in control. It's and real
to,
good.
To what an extent that he's lost control, too, that he, I mean, this is a waking delusion that's utterly convincing to him. Like, this is what Mr. Robot is able to do at a snap. And this is why you need the Colonel Panic.
Right. We did kind of skip a scene here with Mobley on the subway trying not to look suspicious with these cops on board. And then they leave. Darlene sits down and they talk about Romero's death briefly. Mobley's pretty broken up about it, but all Darlene really cares about is saying, I told you so. I told you he's a liability. And also wondering whether anyone saw him at Romero's house.
Do you think Darlene was actually thinking that Mobley should have killed Romero's grandma?
So that has me wondering, and it also has me wondering if maybe she didn't do the hit on or commission the hit on Romero himself. You know, I mean, a lot of people are suspect in this episode.
Yeah, because that's what my first thought is. I felt like that's definitely where her mind was going. Like, you know, did anyone see you? And like, oh no, just a bunch of looky-loos. And well, here comes the box cutter. I thought she's extremely sketchy in this episode.
She is, and I think actually her path, I don't know if it parallels it or contrasts with it, but we're later on talking with Angela, and Phillip's like, you need to take emotion out of the equation, right?
Right.
And it feels to me like Darlene almost kind of has when it comes to certainly Romero, who I don't know how well she knew him.
Right.
But, you know, she's pretty callous about his death there.
Yeah, no, totally. Yeah, and the other thing is, like, yeah, I feel like I am starting to suspect her, but on the other hand, since the other characters in the universe are also starting to suspect her, I guess I got this prejudice that it can't possibly be her then.
Okay.
You know, like, I'm right. Playing this game of chicken with the S-mail, and I don't know what's up and down.
Sure. Okay, and in this scene, Mobley tells Darlene that Romero's mom saw him at the house,
right,
which comes up later. So we talked a little bit about the cement scene and the vomiting scene. Super gross. Let's move on to Angela going to see Phillip in his office, who offers some condolences.
So what we've seen with Leon and Adderall and all that, are we RIP Prison Theory? Because both of us thought it was pretty plausible, but after we recorded last week, I started thinking about it over the weekend. I'm like, you know, he met with his therapist. Like, how in the world would that work in prison? And some of these shots and the fact that he would get Adderall in prison and do this overdose and vomit in his cell and nobody... I just felt like it got less and less plausible. And the fact that now that we know that... You say his name is Ray, Craig Robinson's character?
Yeah.
The fact that he is doing criminal stuff on the outside and not at all acting like either a guard or a prison counselor. I mean, you can make the argument in the first one, but it's feeling like less and less as evidence is starting to fit that blatant, literally nothing we see is real kind of theory. What do you think?
I think I'm with you. I don't know that it's 100% dead. I mean, they could still pull it around, but yeah, I'm definitely leaning away from that now. Is there anything to the fact that Ray doesn't have his dog with him in this episode at all?
That's interesting.
I hadn't really thought about it until you started talking about him and I remembered, hey, he doesn't have his dog.
Well, it's funny because like the whole, I thought someone noticed late last week, we got a shot in the arm of the whole is Elliot Leon theory, because people pointed out that Leon has a bandana on his head. Mr. Robot ties a bandage very, very much the same position and stuff that the bandana is on Leon's head. Next time we see Leon's not wearing the bandana. Mm-hmm. Almost as that if this metaphorical bandage switched from Leon to Elliot. And I'm like, oh, that's interesting. The shot in the arm. And but then, you know, they kind of identified them as two separate, like why would or how would Elliot give himself Adderall? Do you know? But on the other hand, like, you know, that stuff, that game they're playing with the head wound and the bandage, that seemed pretty deliberate, too. So what the fuck?
Yeah, it could be. I mean, it's certainly possible that they're also not the same person, but are in prison together.
Yeah, but what you said, now he's missing a dog. Like, if you, right. part of your evidence was, well, that's a therapy dog, well, then, okay, what mm-hmm. the fuck? Where's the, you know?
Sure.
And how does the cybercrime stuff fit in with all that theory, too? I don't know. I thought it was a tough week for the prison theory. Strong theory. good week one theory coming out of the gate.
Yep.
Got me excited for week three and four theories.
All right, let's move on to Angela. She's in Philip's office. He's offering condolences for Gideon's death. Then he tells her to change the interview that she set up, that she went to such lengths to set up last episode, to Fox News instead of Bloomberg, and to get final approval on all the questions, whole lot more demands. And she protests, and Philip invites her to dinner later in the week and agrees, yeah, let's keep the interview on Bloomberg TV. It's a better fit. And then before she leaves, he notices her looking at this framed Franz Ferdinand assassination flyer, mm-hmm. I guess.
That's the thing that started World War One.
Right.
In a roundabout way.
Sure, yeah.
A couple things. The restaurant is called Fidelio's, which, you know, I don't speak Italian, but that seems like it has something to do with Fidelis, you know, the Latin concept of faithfulness, loyalty, like the Semper Fidelis Marine slogan, always faithful.
Okay.
And, you know, we had the, what was that, the name of the notebook that you pointed out? Conficture, which,
yeah,
the Latin, like that. The Latin root of that was like the complete opposite. It was like dishonesty and fantasy, yeah, like, and all that. Uh-huh. So, I don't know what to make of that. Like, is the show trying to say that the way these men are viewing the world is fundamentally more real than the way Mr. Robot's viewing it?
I don't know. I mean, I guess, what do you think Sam Esmail's sort of views on it would be? You know, I don't know a ton about the guy, but it seems someone who makes this show.
Well, I mean, I don't know. Like, I suspect that he seems like he's a pretty liberal guy, and he doesn't like, you know, global free trade and some of the things that are happening. And
right.
But he also might acknowledge that, that's the way the world is. It's a kind of Darwinistic predatory thing, is the way the world is set up. Like, you know, and Mr. Robot's essentially trying to fight this natural behavior. That still can be a hopeful message of like, well, you know, that's one of the emergent qualities of our consciousness is empathy and compassion. So, yeah, you can argue nature, you know, red and tooth and claw all you want, but at the end of the day, we're compassionate beings, and we want to move towards a society that's no longer Darwinistic, et cetera, et cetera. But I don't know. But within this universe, with Angela being kind of tempted by, like, a literal satanic figure, I don't know. I'm just trying to pick up all these illusions.
Yeah, I mean, I'm with Angela. I don't, whatever this guy's up to, I don't trust him.
Yeah. And also, what the hell is semifreddo?
It's some pasta dish.
It's, yes, surely, but I was expecting for, I was hoping for a little bit more, man, because you know, you've never had semifreddo until you've, I was like, I've honestly never had semifreddo. Like,
neither have I.
So. I've had chicken Alfredo. The sort of Fredo is definitely there, but well, what is semi-Fredo? It's like it's halfway between Fredo and what? Spaghetti? I don't know.
And then you got just straight up Fredo, and nobody wants to be that.
No. You never go full Fredo. All right.
Do you have anything, any comments about the Franz Ferdinand stuff? We know his assassination there. Is basically what triggered World War One.
Well, and the thing is,
such a small action in context, right?
But that like there was no damn good reason for all of the world to go to war over that incident, but because of the way all the complex European alliances worked, mm-hmm. it was like this game of continual escalation. Like people are putting their hands over each other's hands on top of a baseball bat, and then, you know, it's like it embroiled in up the big powers, the Germanys and the Frances and the England and Americas over this stuff that happened in, you know, what is it, some kind of Serbian civil war in the former Ottoman Empire. Mm-hmm. And so some very minor nobility. It all got, you know, at any point someone could say, like, you know what, this is stupid.
Right.
Let's not throw away 100 million lives. But no one did. So...
Yep. So it all started. I think, honestly, we're in for some pretty apocalyptic shit here in Mr. Robot, because I view this as the Franz Ferdinand assassination as basically Mr. or not Mr. Robot, but Angela's parents getting killed, right? And that's the thing. Like,
okay.
I'm viewing this from that lens, where
because I
a
was
a very small thing they thought at the time has kind of escalated into this massive event now that is taking down E-Corp.
It's interesting because I actually thought they were trying to draw an association from the Archduke Ferdinand's assassination to the attack from F Society, and I'm like, well, shit, if that is to that as World War One is to whatever we're going to have now, then good God, apocalyptic, right? Is right. But I think you might be right that this and you know.
Well, I'm also going there.
Right.
I think, you know, that's all tied into that's of a piece.
Okay.
Because, you know, that's the thing that killed Elliot's dad. Like, there's a lot of stuff tied in up in that leak, right?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And that's the thing. It's like, which is the originating event, you know? Like, Archduke Ferdinand was a single isolated thing, whereas I guess in this universe you're supposed to believe that E-Corp has done so much shit that, say, Angela and Elliot, you know, Elliot decided to get therapy and get healthy and stopped his nighttime crusader, and Angela just, you know, kept her, you know, nose to the grindstone and didn't become a warrior for justice for her father, someone mm-hmm. else would have. It was inevitable. And
yeah,
and that's
yeah.
kind of like, that's the thing, like, a lot of historians will be like, you know, yeah, technically this is the instigation of World War One, but the way things mm-hmm. were going with the military build-up and the competition and the paranoia between the powers, that this was a powder keg, this was the match that lit it, yes, but had the Archduke survived or this assassination attempt never happened or was foiled, it would have happened maybe months later. So
right.
it's kind of, I guess, yeah, the more you think of it, the more those historical illusions kind of fit on multiple levels.
Yeah, I certainly think so. And it's, you know, it fits in with that idea of control being an illusion as well. Because
right.
the way that they were operating and just their basic philosophies, you know, put into motion things that they couldn't control.
Right.
So yeah, I don't know. I think if you look at World War One as a portent for what's to come on this story, yeah, it could go real deep, real
sure.
dark. Anyway, so we go to the to Dominique, who is laying awake at 4 a.m. watching TV, reading articles about Gideon, and she gets ready for work, which includes multiple cups of coffee and a long ass procedure. I don't know when she leaves, but she starts getting ready around 4 a.m. and the sun is up.
Yeah, you got to start your day with the Highwaymen. Can't start your day without Johnny Cash and Kris Kristofferson crooning about their weird. That's a weird song, man.
I did not look it up. What's that? What is it about?
Okay,
you
so I first was exposed to this when Johnny Cash died, and I started going on this Johnny Cash, and I was like, man, this guy's makes some really amazing music, and I bought a couple of his greatest hits albums, and this was on one of them. I guess back in the 80s that Kris Kristofferson and Waylon Jennings and Johnny Cash and Willie Nelson formed a country supergroup. They called
right.
themselves the Highwaymen, and their inspiration was this song that was from, I think, the early 60s that they covered. And it's essentially each one of the artists sang a verse about a man, like, you know, Willie Nelson started that he was a highwayman, and you know, he killed a bunch of dudes, and he robbed a bunch of maids, and then they hung him. And then Johnny Cash was a sailor on the high seas, and he died in a storm. And then it ends with the last one, I forget who it is a starship captain, you know. But it's
okay.
like it's like a kin. So then I never could figure out. It's like, okay, is this like essentially a bunch of ghosts in some kind of weird Valhalla sharing notes, or is this like? You're supposed to understand that this is one kindred spirit that's embodied different, mm-hmm. you know, like a reincarnation kind of thing.
Okay.
Where, like, you know, Highwayman's a lawless guy, but, like, a sailor is, you know, he's doing legit stuff. And then one guy, I think, was, you know, some sort of he was a bridge builder or a dam builder that got killed in him. So it's like, you know, one guy's bad guy, one guy's good guy, one guy's just a blue-collar worker, and one guy's James T. Kirk. Like, that's what the song's about. What the fuck this has to do with Mr. Robot other than the duality of man and, like, the fact that you can have multiple spirits in one person?
Right.
I don't know.
Okay. Cool. I don't know. I can't say anything about it, so.
What is, what does Dom have in her safe?
Her badge, I'm pretty sure that.
Her badge.
Probably her gun, her phone for work.
But she had all these, I think, hard drives or maybe DAT tapes that were labeled. One, the top one was labeled September, and the other one was labeled June, and I believe there was 2 stacks of 6, so...
Huh.
I mean, you know, so what we know about this character, she speaks Farsi. She's running an app on her phone that's supposed to help her overcome social anxiety. She can't sleep. She listens to the Highwaymen. She's on Reddit's makeup addiction subreddit. And she's got some kind of high-tech stuff in her, and 12 months worth of high-tech stuff in her safe. Probably too early for us to figure these things out, but I'm just throwing out all these details we're getting into her character so that when they pop up later, we can be like, aha.
Gotcha. Okay. So she goes over to the scene of Romero's death, and she starts investigating a little bit, asking around as far as what they've found. One of the agents there is sick, and he's contaminating the crime scene both with his sickness and his agent's incompetence.
This is Keystone Cop shit, man.
It really is. Like the tone of CSI?
The tone of this scene is kooky. It's kooky.
Okay, sure. He shows her a list of FBI agents that Romero had printed out, apparently, and she takes pictures of it.
She was on one of those the lists.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Later we find out her name actually is on that list. Because it's a list of all the agents in the FBI, right?
Right, a partial list that got leaked several months earlier in this universe. She says.
Mm-hmm. We don't really know who leaked that.
Yeah,
but it sounds like it could be someone from within the FBI, even, or maybe it was just hacked out of their computers. Who knows?
So, what is the point of this scene? Is this supposed to draw a further parallel? Well, first of all, what do you think the point of this scene is? Before I start suggesting things to you.
I'm wondering if this isn't setting up. So it's probably doing multiple things, but the agent's sickness to me, like, it felt very much like they're setting up a problem with disease to come. Like, if you don't have money and the infrastructure starts to crumble, what happens when people start to get sick in big numbers?
Which is another World War I illusion. You first had the war, and then you had Spanish influenza, and you know, it's like there's a reason that a lot of millennial cults popped up. It did seem like it might be the end of the world,
right? So I think that's all just kind of tied up in this, and I don't know if they're going to run with that, and maybe we'll see bigger problems with sickness in the future of this show, but I think that's part of it. What about like the tech part, you know, like these modified ports and the hard drives being destroyed?
Well, I kept on thinking that maybe they're trying to draw a lot of parallels between Dom and Elliot, because in season one, it was a story of Elliot, who is this super competent person, and everyone else in his work was kind of like thumbs up their asses.
Yeah.
Like, he was literally the only one, as far as we could tell, at Safe, all Safe, that was worth a damn. And, you know, thus far, the people talk about the FBI in this hushed tones, but then we see it, and the FBI agents are a bunch of dumb fucks. Well, were these guys FBI agents, or were these just NYPD?
I think they were local.
Okay.
I don't think they were federal.
Okay, cool. But still, like, the fact that the law enforcement, which everyone fears in this world, is largely a bunch of doofuses.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that Dom is the Elliot of the law enforcement. Like, she's the one that knows what the hell she's doing. If people would only listen to her, then evidence wouldn't be on fire.
Right.
They are trying to draw some obvious parallels between Dom's experience and Elliot's.
Yeah.
It makes me wonder whether she... You mentioned last week that she was going to be the primary antagonist.
Sure.
Maybe she'll end up being co-opted in a similar way that...
Okay.
Well, because, you know, I don't think
Angela
anyone called,
was, right?
or Tyrell Wellick, like, no one called that him and Mr. Robot are going to work together by the end of the season, yet they did, after a fashion that's kind of mysterious, and we still don't know. Maybe Mr. Robot killed him. I don't know.
Yeah, that could be interesting. I wouldn't mind seeing her, you know, not just, like, physically going toe-to-toe with Elliot, but also mentally and ideologically.
Yeah, I mean, she's running around catching the bad guys. What has it gotten her? It's gotten her sleepless nights and cyber sex addiction that she doesn't feel good about, and you know, whatever else is going on with her crippling social anxiety that she's able to mask by speaking Farsi in quick stops. I don't know.
All right, let's move on to Darlene and Mobley visiting Trenton to discuss Romero and what they should be doing next. And Mobley suggests that maybe the Dark Army could be killing them off, and Elliot could actually be helping them. Mm-hmm. Darlene says, "No way, man," and tells him to be cool. And once Darlene leaves, Mobley tells Trenton that Elliot and Darlene could be trying to eliminate them to cover their tracks.
Because they are, in fact, the tracks he speaks of.
Yep. They sure are.
Which, again, anytime the show itself is nakedly saying that I should be suspicious of something, of course I'm like, well, they're just trying to misdirect me.
Yeah, exactly. I had the same thought while I was watching it. Oh, that's an interesting theory. No, they wouldn't tell me that if that was true.
Yep. Couldn't possibly be true.
So, I don't know. This show seems to do a pretty good job of showing you things that are real and things that aren't real and letting you try to determine which ones are fictions.
It's one of those things where, like, just when I start to feel foolish that I'm bringing all this meta shit into the analysis, then, you know, I see some contest they're doing and I'm like, oh, man, I don't know. Maybe this is adding up to something.
Yeah, and when they put as much effort into the alternate reality stuff as they have been, you have to think, okay, there's meta here to be explored.
So that's the other thing, is what's killing me is that we had to make this podcast work right now as we speak. The virtual reality experience is only going to be available for like 30 minutes today is happening. If you've got a virtual reality device, you have to have like Google Cardboard or something at least that level or higher. That they've got this exclusive thing that they're releasing. It's called the Mr. Robot Virtual Experience. It happened by the time you hear this, it's 1:45 p.m. on Thursday afternoon. And like, I don't have a VR device, so I couldn't do it anyway. But I'm sure that'll be a hot topic for discussion next week on the podcast, whether it was cool, what new information we found out, whether it was kind of a gimmicky or just kind of a drink more Ovaltine situation or what. But, you know, that's pretty fucking crazy.
Yeah, I think it's going to be interesting to see how people try and capture VR sessions, because I'm sure somebody out there is trying to do it.
Well, that's the thing. Like, it doesn't have to be VR. I mean, you just eliminate one eye's worth of detail, and it's essentially whatever you're seeing is on a video. So, I'm confident there'll be a YouTube that has the whole thing on.
Well, I mean, what do you mean the whole thing? If it's like a 360 experience,
yeah,
it's only
if they're not
where you're
interacting
looking.
With everything. Because like I was messing around that Who Is Mr. Robot site, and it gives you a limited amount of commands, and I was just typing in random stuff. Like I typed in F Society, and it took me to a whole like it took me to a bonus site, and I'm like, mental note, I'm gonna have to go back. And so I started trying like, you know, Darlene and Ray, and like I started typing in characters' names and different stuff, and I haven't got any further than just F Society. But by the time this season's over, who the hell knows what they're gonna be doing with this stuff? But I just thought it's crazy the fact that they're doing this VR thing that's time locked for like 30 minutes on a random Thursday afternoon.
Yeah, that's cool though. I like it.
Yeah.
Okay, so Ray's sitting across the table from a guy who's been doing some tech work for him. Ray complains that his website's down and this guy needs to get it back up. The guy tearfully says, "Look, I can't figure out how to fix it. They need to migrate to a site that's more secure, or migrate the site to servers that are more secure." Ray goes downstairs to a van where he tells the guy who did the beating, apparently, that they need to look into this migration because this guy really doesn't know what's up.
Yeah, he's thumbs up his asses. It sounds like these guys got their hands in their Bitcoin wallets and keep crashing a server, and that sucks. Like we talked about last week, like if someone started encrypting Bald Move podcasts, it's pretty much, well, I guess this is our life now, because sure as shit, we won't be able to figure out how to stop it.
So I'm trying to figure out who Ray is and what he does, because he seems to be a bit of a confidence man himself. I think my best guess right now is that he's running some kind of Silk Road style website ring.
No, I got it all figured out. He's running a CSGO gambling site.
Okay. And right. did he talk about it on his YouTube channel at all?
Yeah, and Gaben is cracking down on him, so, you know.
Fair enough.
He's got to stay agile.
But, you know, when you talk about emptying Bitcoin wallets and servers that keep crashing, to me, it says organized crime. It's
some kind of
dark
net thing, yeah.
Right, deep web bullshit. Yep. It maybe even this guy could be Leon's supplier because we know, like, if you assume he's into drugs, we know, okay, he got the Adderall from somewhere. They are, I guess, tangentially connected.
Sure.
Somehow through Mr. Robot.
Yeah,
maybe.
You wonder maybe Leon's the one that turned him on to him.
Right.
Because he found out about Mr. Robot somehow.
Yeah. Yeah, so I don't know. I mean, there's not a lot to go on there other than Bitcoins and web servers that keep crashing.
Yeah.
So we'll see.
Bald move story. Bitcoins and websites crashing.
I'm sure we'll get more info on that pretty soon.
Yeah.
I do like, you know, they're really trying to make Ray into not a complete bad guy here, even though he's clearly into some nasty business and he's beating
people up. He's got principles. Yeah.
But he does have principles. And, you know, he's not mean beyond reason.
But he also does, he definitely has a commanding presence. Like, I don't know if he's the boss of the organization he works for, but he's certainly the boss between him and this thug that's beating up dudes on his behalf. Like, right. He speaks with authority and, like, not giving a fuck, and this guy's clearly an underling.
Yeah. Okay, let's move on. I just realized, man, we're only, like, halfway through this. So
we're 53 minutes on the podcast, so.
So,
yes.
Elliot's, now that he's been awake for 2 days on Adderall, he looks freakishly happy, and he's feeling great, man.
I thought him laughing was unsettling.
Yes, every time that man smiles, I get creeped out. His life has turned into some kind of surreal video game, and he's strung out as fuck, but,
right.
You know, he's happy because Mr. Robot's gone. Mm-hmm. But then on day five without sleep, everything changes. People start talking backwards. He's zoned out. On day six, finally his kernel panic sets in, and he has a real rough go of it.
So I noticed that they show that he has a steadily dwindling supply of Adderall. And then on day six, they flash. The first thing they show you is that little, you know, what do you call those? The Ziploc bag, the little drug pouches. Mm-hmm. The teenth pouch. That he's out. He's out of Adderall. So are they implying that he could have kept going, but he's out of Adderall and he can't do it, or what?
That's a good question. I'm not sure. Because, right. You know, I don't think it was. The kernel panic didn't set in necessarily because he's out of Adderall, so I don't really know where they were going with that.
Mm-hmm.
But I do really love the little things they do with, like, you know, sound effects and the stairs that light up, making it feel like a video game almost.
Yeah, it was so awesome. And the march of Elliot's, like, all the different Elliot's are slightly out of sync in time, and the bloodshot eyes that they zoomed in, and you actually see almost like burst blood vessels.
Yeah,
they're not just bloodshed, but he's actually made from either vomiting or the overall the Adderall overdose that he's actually burst blood vessels in his eyes.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty sweet, pretty sweet.
Yeah, and they've got, like, later on when it goes dark, and you've got, like, artifacting visuals, which is really cool. Like, his hands start to pixelate.
Yeah.
And then Leon starts talking
backwards.
Which at
first I was like, fucking Time Warner. God damn it.
Right.
And then
right.
I realized, oh, it's this is a deliberate effect.
Okay.
Because every once in a while
my
shit will just do that. It'll just start pixelating.
Yeah, same here. And, you know, I'm in an Airbnb right now. I don't know what the network's like. I don't know what to expect. So, like,
right.
There's a scene later on where Ray meets Elliot with the journal, and that has, like, a portion of it, for me, in my recording of it, where it skips and it goes to black for a bit. Did that happen on your recording?
How long of a bit?
Like, a second.
I don't think so.
Okay.
Because I didn't, I noticed the digital fit, but I didn't notice the other. Now, maybe I just didn't notice it, but...
Maybe.
I scrolling down. I certainly don't have that in my notes.
Okay. If anybody else saw that, let me know, because I feel like I'm going crazy at the moment trying to determine what's actual artifacting and what's part of the show.
Are you actually talking to me on the phone right now, Jim?
I don't know. How would I tell?
How would you tell?
I talk to Mr. Robot sitting next to me.
Right. You could be dreaming right now.
So the backwards talking stuff, a lot of people on Reddit have, you know, picked that apart and said, oh, he's actually talking about a Seinfeld episode called The Betrayal, which that episode played in reverse. when it was aired. So
yeah,
that's
it
kind
was
of
like a Memento type of deal.
Yeah. Pretty cool. I don't know if they're actually hinting at anything broader than just like this tongue-in-cheek.
Did you see that someone slowed down and decoded a large part of what Elliot was talking about in super fast speed motion?
I did, but I don't remember. I didn't write that down.
All right. So here's what it these people did, like some they did some kind of spectral stuff where they took out the main narration, which sound was like very, and it was very hard to understand until they cleaned it up. And I'm trusting that, you know, the Reddit sleuths did their job, which, you know, they're pretty fucking good at this.
They are.
Elliot says, at the most romantic time they've ever had in their lives, two dreamers alone dreaming of dreams. Okay, which one? See what that's like. Always wanted to go to, and then it's intelligible because you cannot hear it over the main dialogue. And then it resumes, and see what that's like, go together, and maybe in an isolated place. Have each other, maybe. Two dreamers alone dreaming of dreams. That could be a reference to Elliot and his sister. You know, their shared dream of bringing this about. This could be a reference to maybe Elliot and Dom, or Elliot and Mr. Robot, the two dreamers that are kind of at, you know.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I don't know to what extent Sam Esmail expects people to decode this. At this point, after seeing Hacking Mr. Robot and reading some of the coverage this week, I feel like that these are all at least Easter eggs. Like, he intends you to decode this stuff and, you know, harness the power of the internet to make these uncrackable puzzles crackable. And to what extent is actually pointing to something happening, or their clues, and to what extent it's just, you know, a nice little exercise, that's what I don't know.
Yeah, regardless, I think it's cool as shit.
This was amazing. The way it starts off goofy and funny, and, you know, the we talked about the sparkling dish and the slam dunk, woo! And right. Then, like, the shining children, and he's like, yep, this isn't good.
No, you're not buying any of this shit, are you?
Right.
And I'm
now,
not.
Isn't, so I... What happened when a mat crashes? Is it true that there's like a swirling rainbow pattern?
Yeah.
Okay.
Like it's going on in his eyes.
Okay. So yes. That's what because I don't have a Mac, but I think I've seen one crash, and I remember it being like a pinwheel effect. And if that's what they're, you know, trying to show, they show the old school like Unix shell kind of kernel dump. And then they were doing that to kind of, I guess.
Yeah, so there's
Mac-like.
There's actually a lot of stuff in that. I don't know if you mind Reddit for this, but like this Who is Mr. Robot site that you were talking about earlier.
Right.
If you dig deep enough in there, if you go into the terminal and there's an unlisted directory, the one that's not on the desktop. And
which
you
just
find
popped up last night.
Right. And you can find a file in there called kernelpanic.log. And inside there, there's a reference to a virtual machine app called Xen. And apparently at the bottom of this kernel panic message, I want to give credit to Jayco81624 from Reddit for this thing, because he did all this digging. He says that the kernel panic message says the kernel panic happens in DOM 0 of Xen, which is DOM 0 would be the host operating system. So if you want to extrapolate on that, I guess you could say he certainly thinks it proves that Elliot is the real person in this show.
Okay.
Not Mr. Robot, not Tyrell or anybody else dreaming of Elliot. It's actually Elliot at the root of all this.
Okay.
Which I don't know that I'm 100% on board with like that as proof, but it's certainly interesting.
Sure. Did you actually see that? Because that the thing that's in the file is the same stuff that's actually flashed on the show several times, and that is also copied into his journal. And he's also, it's Xen spelled with an X, but also, you know, it's not hard to find an association to the concept and of being Xen and Eastern philosophy.
Sure.
Did you actually see the message decoded?
Are you talking about the hex code in there? Yes, I did.
Okay, you want to share that with us too?
Sure, yeah. Within that, and I saw Tom Grooves on Reddit decoded this. He says it translates to init decode sequence, 5 down, 9 across, skip truncation, question mark.
So it's on the surface level is a 5.9 reference.
Right.
What it means, anything else will be determined. But so far, just seems like a little Easter egg pointing to the 5.9 event again.
Yeah, for sure. I don't know if people are familiar with what a virtual machine is, but it's basically a piece of software that allows you to run one operating system within another.
Yeah.
So it relates back to Elliot in that, you know, he's an operating system kind of running Mr. Robot. And later on when he... Actually, in this scene where he's, like, talking about his panic, how, you know, it's just kind of there now. It's part of the system.
Mm-hmm.
It's not even burrowing in anymore, or settling in, as he calls it.
Mm-hmm.
So at some point, you wonder where, you know, the virtual machine just becomes the host operating system.
Right, and that's the fact that, like, I feel like that this is a very grim realization, that the assertion he made last week that I'm not going to go crazy, you are, it seems right. to imply that this plan has backfired. And, you know, that's the thing.
Exactly.
Like, I feel like this is what you see with people that try to self-medicate their mental problems, is
yes.
that they cling to this thing and they think that there's new sensation and it's working, but actually what they're doing is making it worse, which, you know, if you're on the verge of a panic attack and you're in a manic depressive episode, going 5-6 days without sleep, not a great solution. But it
right,
seems
but,
like it would be a good solution in the state
yes.
in which you are in, you know? But
right,
but
and they're not doing, like, people who are suffering from mental illness don't do these things for no reason.
Right.
Right? There's certainly a mentality, like, a certain line of reasoning behind it. It's just based on faulty information.
Right. I mean, some people might wear tinfoil on their head. Some people might make a time machine out of cardboard and, you know, dryer vents. And some people might overdose on Adderall and stay awake for 6 days. It's
right.
But you know, it's definitely, I guess we should have seen this coming, that he's got a legit mental illness and he's trying to go, you know, all natural and treating it, or I don't know what you'd call it. He's self-treating and diagnosing himself that it wasn't going to work out well, and it doesn't look like it has.
Right. And it makes me wonder also about Ray when they're doing all these different things with mental illness, because certainly I think that's a form of mental illness, talking to someone who you know isn't there.
Sure.
It's, you know, maybe not as severe as Elliot's or as debilitating as Elliot's, but it's a mental illness within its own right, and he doesn't seem to be trying to avoid doing it. He just has given in to it.
Yeah. As someone who catches himself talking to himself from time to time, I will say that I've always wondered, like, is this, on a scale of completely sane to deranged, where does this behavior stack up?
Right, and it's also interesting in that he kind of realizes it's a little bit insane.
Sure.
Not trying to use insane there as disparaging, but...
But it works for him, too.
Right. And he doesn't feel like it's very harmful to him, so he continues with it.
Which is funny, because that's essentially the exact same thing that Mr. Robot's doing with Adderall. It's just a different scale. And
right.
Also, it's like, I feel like that everyone has little moments in their life where they do kind of silly things to get them by or whatever.
Sure.
You know, that can be an episode that people recover from, or it could be the start of a crippling depression, a mental illness, and you just don't know until you go down that path. So it's interesting. Maybe Ray, given another 5 years of agitation and unresolved issues with his wife, maybe he would go further up into this dialysis hole and,
right,
you know, Jack Nicholson would start talking to him. I don't know.
All right, let's move over to Angela. She's psyching herself up for a date with Philip, but when she arrives, two of her colleagues are sitting with Philip. They introduce themselves, and Philip is asked to pay up front before settling in for the meal.
So what? Okay, and true or false? Angela is preparing for a bone session.
I think so.
And true or false? She reads as disappointed when she comes up there, and this is just going to be a office meet and greet.
Yep, I think so too.
What?
I don't know why. I don't know what it is.
If we think that she's this double agent, and she's thought that, like, that she's got this great man's attention, and she's kind of, you know, steadily on her manipulation platform. Like, I don't feel like she's disappointed in the sense of, like, oh my god, dear diary, Mr. Price asked me for to dinner today.
Sure.
My heart skipped 3 beats, and I've been aglow ever since. I feel like it's more of like this was the next step in her plan,
right,
and
lost opportunity.
Yeah. Yeah. Also, I thought this was, like, if the opening was his Tarantino moment, this was Sam Esmail's Scorsese Goodfellas moment. You know, the single tracking shot of this person walking through a restaurant, yeah. You know. What did you make of the him having to pay up front? And
I'm glad they did that because it you know, tracks with the kind of financial chaos that we think would be going on at this point. And did you also notice that there are a lot of people outside that window, that restaurant protesting?
Yes. Yeah. So is this to you, because, you know, we bemoaned last week a little bit about how we don't feel like there's realistic consequences that the world has faced.
Right.
Do you feel like this scene is going a long way towards dispelling that, or do you think it's doing just enough, or do you think it's still a little too little?
I think it's doing the bare minimum.
Yeah.
I still don't feel like
maybe not even the bare minimum.
Okay. For me. If you want to go there. I'm glad they're at least keeping that thread alive and not just totally dropping it in favor of, you know, Elliot's madness or Darlene and this killing thing.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And there's also some other things we haven't talked about, like Ray when he's talking to his dialysis machines, talking about how the flower industry is crashing because there's a problem with distribution because, you know, of money, and they can't get the fresh flowers and they're wilting in the trucks. And also he says, plus with the allowance being $50 a day, who can afford flowers? Are they telling us that they, like, you can only get $50 a day out of your ATM? Or what is this?
Maybe.
Because the $50 a day is that like the government slow paying like Medicare and Social Security and stuff? Like, I wasn't sure what he meant by the word allowance. Like, is this a government dole kind of thing, or is this like the banks are like, you can only get $50 a day out of your ATM kind of thing?
That's a good question. I suppose it could be either. I guess I like the reading of the government has instituted some policies to keep people financially solvent.
Putting food on the table, yeah.
Right. Because otherwise it's just mass chaos, right? I can't eat. I'm going to start killing to eat.
Right. So. And you also wonder, like, because I'm going to do some quick, 300 million people, give or take, getting $50 a day.
Right.
That's like $15 billion a day if that's the relief program they're suggesting. And I don't know if that's like head of household or every adult or every man, you know, if it's man, woman, and child, you'd have to add a couple, another zero or so to that. But man, if that's what they're doing, if some kind of government dole situation, that's just country's hemorrhaging cash.
It's drastic. And I mean, maybe it does paint a bleaker picture that that's just kind of in the margins.
But that's
right,
preferable
now
to the entire economy. Like, that's just showing the links they're going to keep this thing propped up.
Right, which I like. Okay, we move on to Dom. She's masturbating to this online chat, but she stops to ask Alexa when the end of the world is. Alexa says, it's most likely several billion years from now when the sun goes supernova.
When the Earth is swallowed by a swollen red giant, is that an allusion to clitoris and orgasm?
Or? You know, I had not thought about it, but sure, I'll go down that road with you.
Yeah.
So something about this exchange with her automated home system here prompts her to look at the list of names, noticing that she's on it.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know what's going through her head here. Do you have any?
Well, so I want to disagree. I think she clearly noted that her name was on it when she showed up at the scene of the crime.
Oh, okay.
So this is like some, I share your puzzlement is that I don't know why she keeps coming back to it, and I don't know how this is connected with the end of the world, much less.
Right.
But we're all supposed to notice these things.
Yeah, especially given the end of the world party, right? The flyer. Like, is she worried about the problems being caused by F Society here in such a big sort of societal way?
Yeah, I don't know.
Or, like, this existential crisis that she's having?
Yeah, and I don't know. The other thing is, like, what are we supposed to think about her demeanor and maybe her upbringing that she feels... Like, I read this, like, after she finished with this guy that she's having cyber sex with, that she felt kind of disgust.
Okay.
I mean, what did you read? Like, you know, it's one of those things where, like, oh shit, you closed it after you're finished. You close the tab. Like, what the fuck did I just do? Or what the fuck did I just watch? I wonder why she feels guilty about having cyber sex with a random stranger?
I don't know. I mean, I guess I didn't read as much guilt.
What did you read then?
As I just read, like, eh, I'm done.
Now let's talk about, like, the end of the world.
Right. That's the thing. Like, I don't know what prompted her to go look at that list again.
Mm-hmm.
And to ask Alexa about the end of the world. It seems weird.
So, Alexa, that's real life Amazon's version of whatever Google calls.
Yeah, it's Amazon Echo.
Siri. Yeah, it's the always-on listening device.
Mm-hmm.
Which is kind of... Big Brother-ish as well. The fact that you've got this machine that's always on and analyzing what you're saying to it and sending it to a third-party server and breaking it down and trying to guess what you want. That's
right.
Creepy in certain contexts.
You think there's any chance that this Amazon Echo may somehow be the target of hacking?
Of course.
Because we already saw that happen to Susan Jacobs last episode, right?
Right. Which, and I'm like wondering what she's actually keeping in her safes, because that shows like some kind of firewall that she's got, like, a physical, like something in those things are, I don't know, very secret and either important to her investigations, and she's protecting that. And I don't know, maybe this Alexa thing is going to be some vector. We saw something as innocent as a watch being used to hack in the previous episode. So,
the one other thing I noticed in this, the person she's talking to on chat there is named Happy Hard on Henry.
Yeah,
and it's this is not my insight. This is a Reddit user. Apparently linked that to a Christian Slater movie, Pump Up the Volume, where he plays a character, a radio DJ who goes by the name Happy Harry Hardon.
Huh.
So it might actually be just a sly wink to
that feels
a former
like a,
role.
That feels like a more of a sly wink than a clue.
Yeah, it's just an Easter egg, but I thought it was cool.
Nice.
So we go to Elliot in a group session worrying about Mr. Robot coming back, and this guy tells a story about beating up an Indian store clerk and how God forgave him. When attention turns to Elliot, he goes on what he thinks is an internal tirade against organized religion, which he accidentally ends up saying out loud.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of good stuff in this scene. I don't know. I'm sure you had a problem with the larger message of this. Yes.
Well, no, not the larger message, because I broadly agree with it.
Okay.
But it's one of those things where it's just so over the top and like preaching to the choir that it comes off as pandering. Like it. And,
right.
And, I know that we had these discussions when we were talking about season one of True Detective. Like, I was eating up everything that Russ was spitting up, and you were like, okay, a fuck enough already. Like,
sure.
Lay off the NyQuil, stop the LSD. and I feel like that's kind of where I'm getting with some of this stuff. But then I read a bunch of analysis where people are digging in, and like, if you look at this in the context of his conversation with Mr. Robot last year, where Mr. Robot said, I was supposed to be your prophet. You were supposed to be my God.
Mm-hmm.
So that all of this stuff that Elliot is bitching about God, I think Elliot could apply to himself. That Elliot is supposed to be taking care of his F Society members. Elliot is supposed to be their leader. And Elliot he's God that has shrugged and is like, eh, whatever at this point.
Right.
And he's not looking after his people. Now I'm like, okay, that scene, I like that scene a lot more. Like, but
sure.
My first visceral reaction was like, oh my God, I'm watching some dude masturbate. And it just went on for forever. And that's what I'm saying. Like,
right.
I wonder what this episode looks like with about 5 minutes taken from it. Because the similar thing, this Angela and the scene with Philip that just goes on forever.
Mm-hmm.
And it crosses the line from arty to indulgent. And at least in my opinion.
Sure.
I come around on Elliot's rant about religion, but the Price and Angela scene we're about to tear into, that still comes across as like, no matter how you cut it, like, I don't need that. I don't know that scene need to be like 7 minutes long or whatever it was.
Yeah. I do like the final line, fuck God, he's not a good enough scapegoat for me.
Right.
Pretty good. And also,
the other thing is I thought about how... And this is probably all stuff that people talked about last year when we weren't covering it, but the fact that Gideon, is a very biblical allusion.
Oh, sure.
To this judge of Israel who helped the Israelites destroy the superior army. by largely and the Lord wanted to make sure that the people knew that he saved them and not Gideon, so he made Gideon winnow his forces down towards just is already a tough fight, but it's 300 mm-hmm. against like 35,000.
Yeah.
And he did this weird subterfuge where, you know, he had them all go in the night and he had lit torches and jars of clay, and they all at some point shouted out and broke the jars, and it made the guys so afraid they ran off. Mm-hmm. There is a lot of this allusions to Eliot being God, and the fact that Gideon, I don't know how, because Gideon, you know, is a hero, and he ended up winning the day and being the judge of Israel for like 50 years, and Israel prospered under it. That's certainly not happened with the show Gideon.
Sure.
But I do feel like that name is intentional.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I don't know exactly what it's saying. I mean, I feel like if we had been really on that theory during season one, we might be able to glean a little bit more.
The other thing, and this is something that I've kind of come up with myself, is I interpret this as the exact moment where Mr. Robot reasserts control. Because this is another instance of, like, you know, Mr. Robot getting up and making fun of a guy and getting punched, or like slitting Gideon's throat. This is a situation where Mr. Robot Eliot did something that he is not wont to do, which is let his internal speechifying be audible, and then he throws away his journal.
Right.
Which is what Mr. Robot has been wanting him to do all this whole time, and is a huge security breach.
And get this, it's what directly gets him back involved in the hacking game. If
right.
you say that Ray wants him, as we know, to help with the server.
So, right? Like the subtext of Mr. Robot, you know, being disappointed that Eliot has refused to be his god, and now he's reasserted control. Like, I feel like the scene works a lot better as a subtext than it does as its text.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, that was pretty cool.
Do love the line, "I want to cry, but I'm so high that I can't."
Yeah, yeah.
It's pretty good.
Yeah, and like when she's like, "Eliot, would you like to share?" He's like, "Nah, man, my system's hung," or whatever he said. a lot of funny stuff in this. But I thought even the setup with this guy, like the fact that he's beat up this Indian guy and he turned it into a profound thing for him.
Right.
Like, did you go back and like face charges? Did you pay for this guy's medical bills? Did you go... like any of the other Christian things, or just like you're good with Jesus and that's okay for you? Like, I felt like it was a little bit, you know, as an atheist, mm-hmm. in my capacity of speaking as an atheist, I felt like it was a little over the top anti-religion.
Yeah. And I mean, maybe it lends a little bit of credence to the prison theory once again, right? If this guy beats a man and goes to jail and now he's in this group therapy session.
Sure.
Could be.
A little bit. Yep.
You know, the person whose story I really want to know?
What's that?
I want to know what Steven Tyler is doing wearing a Slash hat in this group. Because, my God, the guy sitting next to Eliot.
I didn't notice.
Oh, wow. You should go check that out.
All right. I will do.
Anyway, dinner's over. Angela's colleagues leave, and Philip asks if she enjoyed the company and explains, you know, how good these men are. We do toys for tots or whatever, and they're great people. And she did. She had a good time. She liked them. Then Philip drops the bombshell on her that they were both in the room when Colby made the decision to cover up the leak in her hometown. When basically all of them did. And also, they've been involved in insider trading, and then Philip gives her a CD with the evidence of their crimes on it. She's confused by this, and she tells Philip, I don't trust whatever you're doing. And he tells her to remove emotion from her decisions. Now, if she does that, does she become more like Eliot? Does she become numb? Because that's how I feel Eliot is a lot of the time. Very numb.
Well, and also, like, would you say Philip is... I mean, I would disagree that Philip has removed emotions from his process. This thing he's doing with Angela feels very emotionally driven.
Yeah, he keeps dancing around that, doesn't he?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Like, he invites her to this thing where he's driving essentially driving his point home, but then he excuses the guys, and it's like, I felt very clear that it's like, I want to bone this person who works for me now, so you guys are dismissed. And then he's just offers this thing about, so I think that's what Angela was thinking too. He's like, oh, we're going to get back to the original plan, and she kind of perks up, but then he's like, oh, these are the scumbags that you were laughing at and thought they were charming, and they're the ones that killed your dad too. Here's the information, destroyment, and that was it. And then she like calls bullshit, and then he comes back and like gets right up in her personal space and is all whispering.
Doesn't it all feel to you like just an elaborate way to trick her into becoming part of this organization?
Like the fact that like you want to get justice, you can take these guys down, but mm-hmm. also know that it will benefit the company because these guys are insider trading. And
right.
they're a liability.
But also you're like scooping out a bad element of E-Corp, right? Like you can do some damage to this beast that you say you don't like,
but it
and maybe
be
there's
damaged.
Good parts
I don't know, because here's the other thing is like if you look at some of the illusions, and this is where like I felt like this scene was too much on a lot of levels, but first there's the reference to Rosencrantz and Guilderstern, which I thought that's weird, because that's if you don't know, those are Hamlet's childhood friends that the king calls on to kind of talk Hamlet out of his suspicion and paranoia. And they fail because they're false friends and Hamlet sees through them. So that's like, you know, pretty on the nose. But their names are Jim and Saul, which I thought was interesting because Jim could be a reference, you know, as the nickname for James. And Saul was the name of the apostle Paul before he was enlightened. That was his name when he was a Jewish persecuting the Christian brothers, and he got struck by... Right. Christ on the road to Antioch, was it?
I don't know what road.
Whatever. Christ struck him blind, and he was led to one of his disciples, and he converted. And then became like kind of the 13th apostle. James was one of, I believe, Jesus' brothers who became one of the apostles. And then, you know, Philip introduces himself as Master of the Universe.
Right.
What's the Mr. Robot pantheon looking like nowadays?
Like, I don't know, man.
He's opposed to Elliot, so like he would be more of a satanic role, but they're giving his acolytes names of the apostles of Christ. So what the fuck? Where?
Sure.
I mean, this stuff just feels like they're piling on these literary and biblical allusions just for grins, which I guess is
and
okay,
they could be.
But it's frustrating when you're trying to figure out what the story is all about.
Right. But it's also interesting here. I think, personally, that this CD, if it were to be turned in, if these people were to be found guilty of insider trading, I think that would hurt confidence in E-Corp. And we know that Philip doesn't want less confidence. He wants more confidence.
Right, so why would he...
So why give her this evidence? What does he expect of her
is it
in
a
this
test?
Situation? Like, it absolutely is
like,
a test.
Like, because when I first watched this, it's like... Philip, if Philip was offered this information, he would use it in a way to blackmail these powerful men in the corporation and get more personal power.
Okay.
Angela is still a low-level executive at best. She's an up-and-comer, but these guys have a lot more, like they're senior vice presidents, and I forget what the other guy's thing, but they're very high up in the company. She now has leverage over them that she can use to get more power over them and their departments in the company.
So he's pushing her up the ladder?
He's essentially like, well, or it's a test. Like, hey, if you're still on the inside, this is a pretty good payout. You've essentially taken down half of the people responsible for your father's, but you're
exactly.
also letting me go. Because I'm ultimately, you know, the buck stops here, et cetera, et cetera. And he's shedding crocodile tears about Gideon and her father this whole episode.
Right.
But I felt like this is a test. Like, you know, I'm giving you a gun that you can use to really hurt the company and get revenge on some of these guys, but it's not. Or you can do what I would do with it. I don't know. It's kind of, I guess, testing her true character.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I read it.
Yeah. Yeah, you're probably right about that. Now, clearly he has an idea of who she is, right? Because, or certainly he thinks that she is the kind of person who won't turn these people in and will actually use this, because I don't think that would look good for E-Corp.
Yeah, but it wouldn't be fatal.
Executives
get convicted of insider trading all the time.
Well, one pancake won't fill you up, but you start stacking them up,
and it eventually
becomes a fatal dose of pancakes. So,
sure.
Like, I feel like he wouldn't want to add to that fire necessarily. But I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong about that.
Suggesting he's going to go into maple panic?
He might. Full maple panic. All right, let's move over to Ray bringing Elliot his journal. that he threw out, and he says he gets it. Now, I don't know how he got a hold of this journal.
He said the chaplain's an old friend of mine, which honestly raises as many questions as it answers.
Okay, sure.
How would he know that you and this guy were connected, and why would a chaplain be a friend of an old cyber criminal? And, you know.
Yeah, who runs like a flower delivery front or something.
Right, like you see this note bad that's covered in craziness, and it's like, oh, you know what? Ray might be interested in this.
Right. Maybe there's stuff about hacking. Maybe the chaplain's involved. I don't know.
Yeah.
Anyway, he tells this story of talking to his dead wife, which seems to resonate with Elliot. This is a scene I was talking about earlier where there was a glitch. I don't know if that was intentional or the cable cut out, but if you could let me know, that'd be great.
Well, I mean, if it was, I would imagine it was intentional because he's the whole, just as his argument is, we're more alike than you think.
Yeah. And it's clear that he's using this as a way to get to Elliot's technical prowess.
Right.
So,
and also, last episode, Mr. Robot framed this as helping a man and get backing and doing what we do, which, you know, Elliot was introduced as like this heroic hacking figure. Like he was this white knight figure, hacking for good. So even though it seems like he's a criminal or involved in criminal, I ultimately think that whatever Ray's doing here is sympathetic. Because, as you said, he's got principles and, you know, he's not just like, he's not a Hollywood villain who'd be like, torture him anyway, you know.
Right, but he is certainly exploiting the weaknesses that he sees, the opportunities to get into Elliot's life.
Sure.
Even if maybe he's not trying to hurt him. Or if he does have some kind of sympathy for him, you know.
Yeah.
Let's move on to Dominic going to Romero's mom's house. She, you know, knocks on the door, gets in because she knows how to roll a mean joint.
Yeah, she does the same strategy Corey Stoll employs in House of Cards, like the rolling right. The fatty. I can't be the man. Look how the fat joints I roll.
Yeah, mama needs her joints, you know? Yeah,
well, I mean, her joints are bad.
It's fuck the police until they're rolling her joints for her.
Yeah, you need good joints to combat bad joints. You got arthritis in your fingers, those are some bad joints. You need some good joints.
Yeah, really love this scene. Just the way she revels in that first puff, too.
Yeah.
It's real good. You know, not quite as good as Leslie's joints. Not as fat, but... anyway, so she asks a few questions about Leslie, who is Romero. It's his first name. And he finds out about a chubby friend of his that visited and how Romero was helping her pack her things for a move. And when Dominic goes to get her a glass of water, she notices that the papers her glasses are wrapped in have code on them. And upon searching further, she finds a flyer for the End of the World party.
Which, you know, it's in light of last week where Darlene is destroying cell phones. I just want to note what a massive breach of security this is to pass out flyers for your headquarters that you're inviting the general public to use those as packing materials and like snippets of code
also,
from the program.
What?
Like,
coder prints out code? Really? I've never seen that.
I know. Like, I mean, yeah.
20 years in development, and I have never seen someone print code ever.
Sure. I've seen people print out. It's pretty unbelievable, and the fact that he would use is this going to be the encryption code?
I don't know.
He printed out the fucking key
It might just be some random bullshit code that doesn't have anything to do with it, but it led her to the End of the World party flyer.
Well, and they also established in the beginning of the episode how impossible this place is to find. It's like off the grid and outside public notice, and like why set up the area? I don't understand the point of setting up something to be so secure and then compromise it with stupid internal security the same episode.
Yeah, I mean, obviously,
to be like, I was thinking like, well, this is going to be her season arc. She's going to have to piece all this stuff together and get closer and closer. And then nope. Actually, season three, she's going to find out their headquarters. And now what?
Yeah, so I think Darlene was kind of right about Romero. He did seem to be a liability, you know, if not because he's got this drug operation, then maybe because he's a hacker who prints out code. Ultimately, it leads her to their hideout, their headquarters, which Yeah. You know, they've pretty much slash and burned at this point. It's not like she's going to get much from that. But what she does get is
well,
DJ
shit.
Mobley.
If she could get this flyer from wrapped around the glass, then right. I don't know. Like how many right. goddamn thumb drives did they leave behind that has their fucking Facebook something. Profiles and their social security numbers. Turns out Romero carved his social security number in underneath the desk. Just that's what he does.
Right. And there's a flash drive under the skee ball machine. No, so the one concrete piece of evidence I do feel like she has at this point is DJ Mobley on the flyer. So if she can maybe track down who DJ Mobley is.
I just did a show. I did a show for a thing.
Yeah, maybe.
I got one leg. What? How can I possibly hack?
Right. You need your legs to hack. Okay, let's move on to the final scene.
Don will be like, maybe that's how you became. You got your leg hacked off, and your only recourse is become a hacker.
Oh God. So Elliot says he keeps this journal in order to control his life. He's talking to Ray here. Ray tells him his wife died, even though she did everything exactly right. Essentially, espousing this control is an illusion philosophy. Ray gets a little too personal with his questions about the journal and Mr. Robot, and then Elliot gets up to leave. But Ray invites him back to play some chess, which he does come back. And when Ray gets up, Mr. Robot's standing there staring at Elliot, and Elliot narrates kind of about the nature of life and control and sort of the troubleshooting methodology for coding. As Dominic finds the location of the End of the World Party, the F Society headquarters.
Mm-hmm.
So when Ray goes into his like control is an illusion, controls like a one-legged unicorn taking a leak at the end of a double rainbow.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, Elliot's so strung out, he's probably feeling you.
Right.
He's probably like, yeah, man.
You
yeah,
seen
it is,
too?
Isn't it?
The horse can piss like no one's business.
Right. And I'm the pot of gold.
Yeah.
Right. So, I don't know. I found the... So, jumping from something which I think is a complete absurdity within hacking, which is printing code, to something which I think makes a ton of sense, which is kind of life as this methodology, this troubleshooting methodology, right? Where you set a breakpoint, you find the bug, you fix it, you move on until you find the next one. And you hope to, at some point, reach something that is... basically a bug-free program or a bug-free life.
Right, and that's what, like, if you don't know, breakpoints are places in the program where you know there's a problem and you kind of suspect that it's in this patch of code, so you start putting breakpoints where you can step through, and when the program goes down that subroutine or whatever method or function, that you can say like stop here, and then the program will stop and you can actually look at its inputs and everything that it's holding in its memory and all of its current settings and compare it to what you would expect. And then if it's going through a loop, you can iterate through it. It's like, okay, is everything happening? It's a way to slow down the execution of the program to see exactly when things are going haywire. And then the appropriate response is to either fix that bug, or if that is an error condition that can happen in your code, to write some error handling around it so it's no longer a fatal error. So there is a lot of interesting, like, maybe this is Elliot's personal growth. It's like, you know, I don't have to force a kernel panic where my whole system dumps. Maybe I can identify the things that are causing my life to go sideways and write, you know, I'm using his terminology, but essentially write code around it so they're no longer fatal errors. They've become handled exceptions.
Right. Yeah, I like it a lot. I think it makes a ton of sense. It's just weird that it comes off the back of printing code.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, Romero is old school, I guess.
I guess so. So we talked a little bit about, you know, what she might find at the arcade and this DJ Mobley thing. Anything else you want to talk about in this final scene, or should we move on to feedback?
Probably should move on to feedback, I'd say. Okay, if you'd like to send feedback, once again, it's robot@baldmove.com. No mister, no dots, just robot@baldmove.com or forums.baldmove.com, where we have a thread that we have each week for the show, and you can talk with your fellow fans there and share theories and whatnot. First up is Chris E. said, in the flashback scene to this is so as is our want, a lot of these first ones are for last week's episode. Chrissy says, in the flashback to the doctor scene, Elliot's father was hiding his disease and refusing treatment, thus the no bills reference. The reason he pushed Elliot out the window was for revealing his secret to his mother. So this is all happening the same day, and he is explaining that he's not doing treatment. Right. So that I was looking at that. It's like, what does he mean there'll be no bills? Like, I was thinking he was talking about the current situation with the son, not his cancer treatment. So that all tracks. Do you think, based on what we saw of Mr. Robot, saw of Christian Slater and his relationship, his father's relationship with Elliot, do you think that this cancer was causing him to act, like did he have some kind of brain tumor that was causing him to act in extreme ways? Because it doesn't seem like the guy who lets his kid off the hook for stealing $20 would be the kind of guy they would shove your kid out the window because he let slip to your mom, to his wife, that he's got cancer.
I get what you're saying. I want to say that it was lung related cancer, though. Did they say, like,
so does he also have some kind of mental illness that he's passed on to me? Because again, like, that's just crazy shit. Like, you don't shove your kid out the window for anything, really.
Sure. I don't know. People find out they're dying, they do crazy things. Example in point, Breaking Bad.
Yeah. No doubt.
So I'm not sure. I thought it was lung related, his disease.
Yeah, I was always trying to find a way to let the Christian Slater character off the hook for that crime. You know,
okay, sure. Yeah,
that like there's more to the story, that Elliot threw himself out of the window or something. But it just doesn't seem. Maybe it's even if there's no other explanation, that maybe that he's suffering from some of the same problems that is causing Mr. Robot to be that's causing Elliot to be violent, and that, you know, because that would be like this thing that his father's passed on to him would kind of fit into a code. Like this is you know, Elliot's a fork of the code of the
right.
of the his father's, you know, code base, where it's merged with half of his mother's, but he's still got these crazy subroutines that are running in there. Literally crazy subroutines. So anyway, I thought that was interesting. He also says, as a general thought, I don't think that all access to money is gone. Records have been encrypted for now, but appears as if banks are still at least operational and people are seen shopping, etc. They're injured but not dead, as Darlene points out. I don't think wiping all the debt is necessarily equal to blowing up the entire financial system. It would be in Evil Corp's best interest to let people continue to have access to cash and to spend money. In fact, you know, as we pointed out, there's allusions to this in this episode, this $50 allowance. But I do disagree. Like, if you don't think that wiping out all debt would end up in the destruction of the financial system, like, I don't mean...
It's like throwing a monkey wrench into gears, right? I mean, it's going to lock everything up.
Banks get their capital? And we know from what happened just 5 years ago that it's not uncommon for banks to be leveraged 8, 10, 12 times, which means for every dollar that they have in their accounts, they've loaned that dollar out 12 times.
Yeah.
So borrowing money from the treasury to make up for it. So
take your savings account, you know, divide it by 8 and say that's how much money you'd have access to in this.
Right. Or situation. 1 out of 12 people will be able to get the money. That's another way to look at it. Like, removing, and again, if it's all debt, that's just such a huge side of this. Of the slate, because it'd be one thing if it's like a one-to-one economy, like, well, for every dollar we've got saved, and that's a dollar that's invested. It's not. It's like a 12-to-1 economy, an 8-to-1, a 6-to-1, you know, whatever it is. There's more of the debt than there is the money that we actually have to spend. So I don't know. I'm not an economist, though. That's just my understanding of it. Anything else, or should we move on?
Let's move on.
Engharad W, I think is how you pronounce her name, said there's pretty much always cops stationed in the vicinity of the Bull on Bowling Green. She's talking about the Wall Street Bull.
Yeah,
it's right in the heart of the financial sector and a really huge terrorist area. Or not terrorist, tourist area.
Oh, God, why would they put it there?
New York City, it attracts them. And lots of people get photographed with bulls, so they're stationed there in case there's any problems. As to your point about how setting the cash on fire could have been a great end to the first episode, you missed the point that this show really leans heavily on their cold opens. I'm personally of the opinion that no show, with the possible exception of Fargo, does better with cold opens. Which is a fair point. Like, you know, yeah, it'd been an awesome ending, but maybe they like to bang up, like maybe Can I just get a word out? Maybe the cold opening makes you sit up a little straighter in your couch. That's more right. of their philosophy. Whereas the finale is a tease for next week more than it is like an amazing moment.
Yeah, I don't know. Regardless, I think it was smart to air those back to back.
She also says the people at the head of E Corp meets with are actual people. They're, although portrayed by actors, Janet Yellen, chair of the Federal Reserve, Mary Jo White, head of the SEC, Security Exchange Commission, and Jack Lew, Treasury Secretary. So those people are all allusions to real life people in the financial sectors of the government.
It's a nice little detail.
Yeah, cool. I don't know why you wouldn't. I guess you're living in a world where Obama's given speech, so they're really. Yeah. Tying that to the real world. How surreal would it have been if they'd gotten the real people?
Pretty surreal.
Yeah. Michael A., which, by the way, he has a column on Medium.com called An Eccentric Life. And I noticed that he reached out to us a couple weeks ago and said that he's going to be writing and he wanted to talk about some points of our podcast. And we're like, sure, you know, whatever, knock yourself out. But then it was weird because I was reading an article that someone forwarded to me in email, and he was referencing the Bald Move podcast, and I was like,
"Yeah."
I went to this thing, and then I saw his name in my inbox. I'm like, "Oh shit!" It all came together. But that's always weird. Like I'm just reading and suddenly Bald Move. Anyway, Michael, go to medium.com and Eccentric Life if you want to see he's got like essentially, you know, an article that points out a few dozen things that you know. That you might have missed with screenshots and stuff. So he does a lot of the same stuff we do, only in the column forum. Said, I'm wondering if you guys could discuss in the feedback section about possible meanings for this. He shows the cover to Elliot's journal, and it says Red Wheelbarrow on it. Looked it up, and the Red Wheelbarrow is a poem by William Carlos Williams. And it contains the few lines below, and he included it all. So the poem goes, so much depends upon a red wheelbarrow glazed with rain water beside the white chickens. That's the poem.
Yep. All right.
So I did some research because I was like, fuck, I didn't even know this was a thing. So now I'm being asked about it. And I came across an article that several poets and English scholars were talking about the meaning of the poem and the fact that this is like on each thing, like so much depends, and it's a new line upon a red you know, another line, a red wheel, and then new line barrow. And they say that a lot of the utility of this poem is in its structure, and that, like, you know, if it was just four lines it wouldn't be as special, but it's just like really crisp picture of this real, and it's the way it's structured is requiring you to think of each thing. And I thought that, like, that jogged my mind that Elliot talks about that his structure and his routine are what makes his life work, that this poem works because of its structure, that I think that that's the analogy that they're trying to go there for. But that's a really tenuous thing for me. White chickens and rain glaze. I don't know.
I don't know what that means either. It sounds like a Bush lyric to me. But let me go down a road.
So
a road you might not like.
Much
with this.
Depends upon. Did you say Beck? You said Beck, right?
No, Bush.
Oh
Bush.
Shit!
It, it
no,
could
I
also
went
be Beck.
I went Beck.
Yeah, it could be Beck just as easily. Let me go down a road here on this, which I think is going to be a little bit crazy.
Okay.
I'm wondering how much. So we know that Elliot has tried to exert control over his life with this routine, right?
Yes.
Mr. Robot keeps saying control is an illusion. You can't do it. Red Wheelbarrow is, you said, written on the cover of his journal.
Yes.
The Red Wheelbarrow shows up in this episode, right?
What?
They mix the cement in it.
Oh,
don't
shit,
they?
You're right.
And they pour that down his throat. And we know that that is, in fact, Mr. Robot getting him back on track, fucking with him.
Yeah.
Is it possible that Mr. Robot is controlling basically everything here in an effort to bring Elliot around to his side, from from the, even the mere fact that he is journaling, because, you know, he called Mr. Robot his god earlier. Well, he's in this group therapy session journaling for it, right?
Yeah.
So I'm putting the pieces together here, trying to make connections to say maybe Mr. Robot is the cause of him journaling. It's the cause of him overdosing. It's the cause of all of this stuff.
Hmm.
Like, he could be pulling the strings basically from the beginning here without us or Elliot knowing.
Well, another thing, way you could look at that is that, so I guess there's two ways to look at that. Number one, Elliot is riding the red wheelbarrow for some reason because it makes him think of structure, and that these are elements that Mr. Robot's able to pull from Elliot's, because he's only can work with the constructs that are included in Elliot's mind.
Okay.
Or it's as you're saying, and Mr. Robot's fucking with him in some subconscious way. Elliot is aware of this, and he calls his journal the Red Wheelbarrow.
Mm-hmm.
out of like this internal, not like a, you wouldn't say an homage, but as an unconscious kind of tick that shows that he's, you know, because, you know, he is Mr. Robot as well as Elliot. So
sure,
yeah, you're right. That is crazy.
Okay, good.
Moving on, the Rick F. says, we talked about the low ratings the show got, the kind of, like, discouragingly low ratings. Mm-hmm. And I haven't got an update this week about, like, you know, what were the plus 3 and plus 5 days and all that stuff. But Rick has a theory. The reason for the low ratings is simple. The USA Network is not part of the top 250 package with DirecTV or Dish Network, and most people are not going to upgrade their programming for just one good show and 20 more bullshit channels. USA Network needs to get in the top programming package, which might be their plan for Mr. Robot. Like, they don't necessarily care what ratings it gets. They're just wanting a lot of people to call and demand that they get USA Group and the basic channel so that they get more money and can do more shows like Mr. Robot.
Yeah, seems like a pretty good strategy.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to stand out on basic cable, yeah.
Yeah.
So good theory there, Rick. Michelle L. says, I don't follow this show obsessively, so this may have been noted elsewhere, but in flashbacks, young Elliot has dark brown eyes. However, adult Elliot has blue eyes, his most striking feature. The actor playing young Elliot could have been made to wear contacts if they couldn't find a suitable swarthy green teen with light eyes. Does this speak to the veracity of the memory? Oh, boy.
Young Elliot is she talking about? Because I think there are multiple young Elliots.
The one in the doctor's office, I assume, since this was for this. Okay. And the thing is, I've heard, like, for example, Emilia Clarke was supposed to wear purple contacts in Game of Thrones, because that's one of the Targaryen features. They have these silver blonde hair and purple eyes. But the actor complained that it was hard to, you know, it was distracting and it was hard to emote and they weren't getting the performances. So they're just like, you know what? Fuck it. Slavish accuracy to the book is not as important as her crushing her scenes.
Mm-hmm.
I noticed that young actor, I thought, did a lot of really subtle things and being like, you know, a young Elliot. And it could be that they wanted him to wear contacts. And they tried it out, and he just couldn't emote as well, and it was distracting from his performance. Or, as you said, this could be something that we're supposed to notice in the meta and understand that this is some kind of fakey, embedded memory or distorted memory. What do you think, Jim?
Yeah, so I was reading around on Reddit, and somebody brought up the question, how old is Darlene? How old is Elliot? And what are their age gaps? Because in a lot of the evidence we see, it's contradictory. Mm. Now, a lot of other people. Well, like, for instance, there's a picture of the family on the beach, and Elliot and Darlene seem to be about 2 years difference. And then if you go to, you know, and I'm going to explain this in a second, but if you go to like the Times Square scenes, Elliot is the only kid there, and it's maybe his mother is pregnant, but Elliot's still the same age. So in that scene, I think it's Elliot, you know, bending his memories to his own will or whatever.
Okay.
Distorted memories. Or maybe it's possible that Elliot, at the point where he was pushed out this window or his dad died or both, has kind of frozen himself in time there. And regardless of the other things he's thinking about with his family, he's always this age.
Yeah, that's a good point, because we know that, you know, Elliot restaged his being thrown out the window with his figment of his imagination father at the pier.
Yeah.
At that Coney Island is where that's supposed to be taking place, right? The boardwalk there.
Sure.
So that's definitely a crucial moment in his life. That's
right. And I feel like maybe he has cemented himself in both, you know, modern time and also that one moment. But I don't know what that speaks to as far as the eyes. I was just, you know, talking about another thing I noticed.
Okay. So yeah, not sure. It could, you know, and that's the thing with this show. It's like, you know, what's a continuity error? What is a choice based on production? And what is meta information that it's vital for us to notice?
Right.
Hard to tell. Josh from Philly says, just want to tag you on that. Your mention of the song in the beginning from the premiere, Daydreaming by Lupe Fiasco. Did you know that aside from just the name of the song being cool to the show, the song is actually about Lupe living in a giant robot? The first lyrics are, "As I spy from behind my giant robot's eyes." Just thought that was a cool tag. Yeah, so I actually looked up the lyrics, and the whole first verse is him using this vehicle, and it's on the album cover, too, of him in this, like, 40-story robot navigating the world and trying to keep it from stepping on women and children, but he's scared of heights, and the view is dizzying, and, you know, that it's a man inside this robot construct. I don't know that there's anything really meta there, except for that's a pretty sick... It works on multiple levels. The chorus... of the Daydreaming works, and then if you know anything about the history of the song, it's a guy inside of a robot that's trying to pilot it around, and he's kind of paranoid and unsure of his limitations, and I thought that was pretty cool.
It is, yeah.
So thanks for the tag there, Josh. Megan S. said, in your premiere podcast, you know how creepy Elliot's laughing is, and it totally was. I got chills. But I was thinking back to when I saw Rami Malek before the show, and the first thing that came to my mind is the PS4 game Until Dawn. My fiance and I played through it not too long ago. Malek plays one of the characters, and he did voice over and mocap, motion capture, which was actually super cool. You go through the game and make decisions that affect the outcome of the game and who lives and who dies. Not going to lie, he was super creepy in it as well. Could also be a cool game for you guys to play through for content as well. I don't know about that. No promises there. But if you're a Rami Malek fan and you want to see how he looks digitized, check out Until Dawn. I'm not sure if that's a PlayStation exclusive or if it was available for
I think
Xbox.
It's PC.
Well.
I think it's also PC. But yeah, spoiler alert, he also looks creepy in that. Like, he's never not looking creepy.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the first thing I've ever seen him in is Night at the Museum. He plays like the ghost of King Tut, or the animated form of King Tut. And he's I wouldn't say he looks creepy there, but he looks like Rami Malek. Jen S. says, listen to your recent podcast, you mentioned that you thought Elliot might have Asperger's. When watching the young Elliot get hurt and go through the hospital, it made me think that he had TBI, traumatic brain injury. The head injury could have caused some degree of brain damage. This could explain his hallucination of Christian Slater and his lack of emotion, paranoia, and loss of reality and memory loss. I made a connection between the scene with young Elliot and his head wound on the scene where he is shot and then is wearing a bandage on his head. He might have been reliving this trauma from when he was a child. He could have been reliving the injury from his childhood over and over. After he was shot, he was writing about how this had happened before. Christian Slater also adds that Elliot has a constant cycle of forgetting what happened, and he can't get rid of him because it'll all just start over again with the memory loss. So let me ask you this before we talk about the meat of this email, because it's going to inform how I approach it. The last season flashback where Elliot was talking to his father about the $20 stolen, did you get the strong impression that Elliot had already developed a pretty strong social anxiety or... you know, some kind of spectrum behavior?
Not really, no.
Because for me, I thought that he was a fairly normal kid in that scene.
Right.
So, do you think there is something to this brain injury forming him into the young man that we see in the show? Or do you think this was something that... he's always struggled with, and the accident either exacerbated it or was a, you know, fallout from, I don't know, I'm not sure where I'm going with that.
No, I think there is something to that idea that, you know, the doctor says, oh, there's no brain trauma or anything, but that doesn't mean there necessarily isn't.
Yeah, especially if we add to the question, is this scene real?
Sure.
You know, yeah. I have find it hard to believe that a child can be thrown out of a second story window and land and not have head trauma.
Yeah. Also, I don't know if you would want to say in earshot of the kid, yeah, the kid's all fucked up in the head now.
He's Looney Tunes. Marbles gone. Funny Farm here. It's just, phew, scrambled eggs.
That's not going to help him out much. So, yeah, he could also just be putting on, you know, he takes a parents out after that, right?
Yeah.
And wants to talk to the kid alone. He might be trying to further diagnose him at that point, along with find out what his dad did to him.
Yeah, because that's my thought was that he was wanting to find out what you know. He was right. Is like some there are charges to be filed here.
Sure, other side of the story.
Okay, so yeah, that seems plausible there, Jin. John E. said, I found an interesting article about the actor that plays Hot Carla, the one that we mentioned, and we couldn't figure out what was going on with her.
The pirate.
It turns out that she is a transgendered woman, which might work in the whole prison theory, as women would not be in a prison otherwise. So, I don't know about that. So, she was born as a man, and there's this really sweet article on Barney's about her father and how supportive he was about this whole transition process and helped his son turn into his daughter.
About Hot Carla?
Yeah, the actress that plays Hot Carla. So
there's stuff out there about her?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. The actress herself. I thought you meant the character.
No, not Hot Carla. Okay. The actress herself.
Gotcha.
And I don't know. It could just be that they needed an actor and she fit the bill for this particular character. It could be this gives a little bit more ethereal quality to the show.
Maybe they're going to explore, you know, her transgendered stuff later.
Well, the other thing is that, like, he's saying, well, would this explain, like, you know, if she was, like, and this is a question I've asked ever since Orange is the New Black came out. Like, they have a transgendered character there who was a man and transitioned to be a woman, and she's currently in a woman's prison. And I've always wondered, like, is society really that hip that they would put a transgendered man into a woman's prison? Or would they be like, well, we don't give a shit what you identify with or how much hormonal treatment or what kind of surgery. It says man on your birth certificate, so guess what? You're going to men's prison. I guess John here is interpreting it that's how it would happen. And this is a hint that, you know, this Hot Carla is a transgender person and they're stuck in prison. But if you go the Orange is the New Black theory, then they would actually put you into the prison that you identify with.
Right.
I don't know.
Arguing about bathrooms nowadays, so
yes.
Clearly we're not very progressive on the issue.
But it's also New York City, which, you know, that seems like that would be left up. I imagine states would have a wide latitude in how they do that stuff. So And honestly, I remember that being a question on the Orange is the New Black podcast like 4 seasons ago. I do not think there was any clear indication of how the criminal justice system would handle that.
Okay.
But I don't know. It could be grist for the mill. I'll throw that link if you want to read about the reason that they wrote about her is I guess she was in a big fashion shoot, but an art shoot. And they did an article on like all the different models that were involved in it and their backstories. Mm-hmm. So I'll throw that in there if you want to see some behind the scenes information. Because again, the story with her and her dad is pretty sweet. Pascal D. from Ontario writes in, said, you guys made a comment in last episode that Angela may have to, quote-unquote, go further in at E-Corp if she, in fact, plans to destroy them. I wanted to share some evidence that, to me, proves Angela is taking a job at E-Corp as part of her plan to ruin them from within. Shortly after she decides to lie about breaking the chain of command with the data file that led to Colby's arrest in Season 1, she knows she's going to be fired. Instead of panicking, she tells her father and Elliot not to worry that she has a plan. Also, in episode 9 of season 1, while sitting at the table about to offer Angela a job, Colby makes a comment, if you want to change things, you may have to change them from within. Could this be Sam Esmail sending us a message? I believe this is all part of an elaborate plan for which will continue to unravel. What are your thoughts? My first thought is, I hope this goes better for her than it did normally Natalie Dormer. What's your thoughts, Jim?
Man, she's really relying on a lot of... hopeful outcomes to her scenario. Because, like,
right.
She wants this guy who she's clearly antagonizing to offer her a job at the end of it. Like, that's her plan?
Yeah.
I don't know that she could be certain or even, like, have a relative amount of assuredness that she would get a job at E-Corp in any way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because it doesn't seem to lead that way logically.
Well, I mean, if she has a plan, because this is also seen in light of the fact her father is saddled this crippling debt that he's not dealing with, that maybe this was, she's speaking to, I have a plan, like, you know, this is going to blow up and I'm going to get justice for you through this E-Corp thing by getting all this information. And then when they offer her the job, they kind of buy her off, that she sees this as a way to strike a broader blow. So I don't necessarily, when she says she has a plan, that she's talking about what she's about to do. Like, she's not prescient. She doesn't know they're going to offer a job. But,
okay,
you know, otherwise, I think you're right on. I think that we are supposed to, like, at this point, we got to understand that Angela is playing a part. Because there's no fucking way I buy that she is gagging for Phillip's old man CEO cock.
Right.
That can't be excited, like, other, and unless it's an avenue to manipulate him and to further ingratiate herself to him for some plan, which I assume is noble, because, again, it's such a wild swing of her character to go this new direction otherwise. Teresa V, she caught that we mentioned about whether there's going to be further augmented reality games or alternative reality games that are coming out, and she said that we actually missed one that first debuted in May, and the Reddit was able to feverishly crack. So in the official trailer when it came out, it launched on May 16th. I'm not sure when this contest was announced or when it was concluded, but at 41 seconds into the trailer, there's like a half second display of someone taping up an evidence box. And if you blow up that, you can see a phone number, 212-804-6003, that was, again, seen for like a half of a second. If you called that, you got a message where it says, "Thank you for calling the E-Corp helpline. Following the recent events, we're experiencing an unusually high caller volume. To avoid waiting and for more information, please visit our webpage at www." And then the message breaks up and a quote plays, "In order for the light to shine so brightly, the darkness must be present." And then there's a series of beeps of two different tones. And if you translate the beeps into a series of A's and B's, you get, you get a abba baba 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 baba, essentially. But.
And that's the end. Good one.
Right. Baba is a Baba Booey joke.
Yep.
But the quote, this thing that in order the light to shine so brightly, the darkness must be present, is attributed to Francis Bacon, who is famous for using this particular Bacon cipher, which they used to decode the beeps, and they got FSOC.DOTSH, which you could write down as FSOC.SH. You go to FSOC.SH. There is an eye, an animated GIF of an eye in the middle that's surrounded by letters and numbers on the page. And if you look at the way the eye is moving and track at what letter, number it's looking at, and you write down the order, you get 4C4F4F4B205550, which, of course, everyone that can translate hexadecimal to ASCII on the fly, that translates into look up, which is a reference to a blinking cursor at the top of the fsoc.sh site. And if you notice the pattern is blinking in, it's actually Morse code.
Oh, my God.
Which translates to leave me here. Which works as the password on the fsoc.sh site that then takes you to a site where you can then join the F Society and give them their F. And I guess the first 590 people that did this got a hoodie and a F Society mask mailed to them.
Holy shit, that's cool.
Yeah. So that's where I'm saying, like, who the hell knows how far this rabbit hole goes? Because this was a fairly elaborate trail left for people to figure out. And I guess after you sign up, it dumps you to the, you know, Who Is Mr. Robot website, which implies that the game is over. But the fact that this site is evolving as the episodes continue to unravel means maybe there is going to be an ARG on top of the ARG. And the fact that they've done it before means that they could probably do it again. So buckle up. Who knows how deep this rabbit hole goes and how many clues there are embedded in these episodes and what to be looking out for. Like, I just feel like that no one can say that someone's obsessively analyzing this show too much at this point.
Yeah, I love it.
That's actually the end of the feedback we have for this week. Again, if you'd like to send us more, robot@baldmove.com or forums.baldmove.com. Jim, any closing thoughts?
Nope. I'm good. Can't wait for next week.
All right. Well, safe travels back to the studio, and we'll get you back and have another podcast out next Friday for next Wednesday's episode of Mr. Robot. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.